the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Does the thought of working for 60 or 70 years fill you with dread? Or can you see the potential for a more stimulating future as a result of having so much extra time? Many of us have been raised on the traditional notion of a three-stage approach to our working lives: education, followed by work, and then retirement. But this well-established pathway is already beginning to collapse. Life expectancy is rising, final salary pensions are vanishing, and increasing numbers of people are juggling multiple careers. And that's the subject of a new book called The 100-Year Life, Living and Working in the Age of Longevity, and one of its co-authors, Andrew Scott, who's a professor at the London School of Business, joins me now. Andrew, let's talk about this, because I can remember when Social Security was put into place in 1933, the life expectancy of a male was age 65. Today, it's probably closer to 85. And as you write in your book, longevity has been increasing by 2 years every single decade. So let's begin with this 100-year lifespan. What is making that possible?
It's a raft of different things. And as you rightly say, if you look at the data over the last 200 years, in every decade, what we call best practice life expectancy, that's the country with the highest average, has increased by 2 or 3 years every decade. So it's plausible to suggest the children being born today have a very high chance of living to 100 or even more. If you look at the work of Professor Jim Vorpal, he says that a child born in America in 2007 has a 50% chance of living to be 104. So, you know, this is this extraordinary increase that's been happening. What's behind it? It's a raft of things. It's certainly partly medicine. It's better income. So the nutritional intake of expectant mothers is better. And a huge role is better public health and better public knowledge. And of course, this is not a gift that everyone faces. I'm 51, so my life expectancy is probably 90, as opposed to my children. And it's not something that's automatic. It's not you take a pill and you get it. There's all sorts of behavioral features that you need to follow, exercise, nutrition, etc., if you're going to get there.
Traditionally, the model, the way it has worked for probably the last 100 years, is the first third of your life is spent in education. You go to grade school, high school, and then college. Then the second stage of your life, you work for 35, 40 years. And then the final stage is your retirement. If indeed lifespans are increasing, and I think, what is it, the probability anybody born today is likely to reach age 100 or 105? What is that, a 50% probability?
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, different people have different estimates, and there's growing inequality that basically higher income individuals, you've got a very high chance of passing 100 if you're born today. Vorpal says 50% of children born in the US in 2007 lived to 104.
You know, this is going to present a problem for governments and corporations, and I want to get into that later on. But let's talk about the gift of life. And you have a table in your book, and it's various countries, and it's this 50% probability of babies born in 2007. In the U.S., the probability of a lifespan is 104. In Japan, it's 107. Now, these are mainly Western developed countries. Andrew, is it much different for, let's say, the poorer countries around the world or third world countries?
Yeah, it is. I mean, life expectancy is growing everywhere, but obviously the richer countries have the better resources and the better nutritional intake. So they've kind of been advancing for a very long time. What you are finding in the fast-growing emerging markets, though, is that they're catching up. They start from a lower level, but they're catching up. So actually, they're seeing their life expectancy increase by more than 2 or 3 years every decade. It's just happening from a significantly lower base.
Now, something also you say in your book that struck me is it's not just the fact that we'll be living longer. Well, when people think of old age, they think of Alzheimer's, they think of incapacity, dementia, Alzheimer's. You're saying that in addition to longevity, we will live more healthily.
Yeah. I mean, you know, again, the averages can be very misleading and not everyone is going to be that fortunate. But there is, of course, rising concern about Alzheimer's. But the evidence suggests that most of these extra years of longer life are healthy years of life. So by and large, the increase in life expectancy has been an increase in healthy life expectancy. There still is that sad end of life phase, but that's kind of being pushed back. So what is really happening is the arc of life is being extended for many people. So you're older later, and I guess that means you're younger for longer. And of course, this means that what we expect from people in their 70s and 80s is different from what we used to expect. You know, I think of my grandparents in their 70s, and they were very frail. But my parents in their 80s kind of matched that, and perhaps I'd be lucky enough to match that in the 90s. And all around us, you can see people who are older doing things differently. I mean, the example I always give is the Rolling Stones, who have an average age of 72, I think. And, you know, that's not what society expects 70-year-olds to be doing.
You know, in your book, you talk about this three-stage lifespan that we talked about, education, work, and then retirement. It's coming to an end. In many ways, we're already seeing traces of that. I just read there's a study out. The number of individuals who are working past age 65 has risen just in the last 7 or 8 years, Andrew, to close to 20%. Because I think one of the things I want to get into is talking about the traditional retirement package. When I got started my financial planning career 36 years ago, you know, an individual would retire. They had a defined benefit pension plan that covered about 80% of their expenses. You threw in Social Security and their savings, they lived quite well. Well, you don't see defined benefit pension plans. You don't see much of them in the corporate sector, and I think they'll disappear for governments in the future. So let's talk about what does that mean for financing a lifestyle? Because it seems like instead of the 30 to 40 year working career, we may be talking about 50 to 70 year working career.
Yeah, I think that's probably true, particularly for the younger generation. I mean, because we are living for longer and healthier for longer, there's a question of how we finance that. I don't like to start there because that kind of sounds rather negative, but you kind of just got to grasp that reality. The 20th century was interesting because you saw this creation of a three-stage life, and a three-stage life worked very well for people with life expectancy of 70. But now people living to 80 or 90, that three-stage life really isn't working. We've already seen the corporates, as you say, drop defined benefit schemes because they couldn't afford it. And that, of course, doesn't mean that individuals can afford it either. So then the big question is, when do you stop work? And certainly, I think people in their 40s and 50s are likely to stop work in their early 70s. And as you rightly say, we've already seen a doubling since the mid-80s, the percentage of people age 65 and over in the US who are working. That continually declined during the 20th century. I mean, it's worth just going back again to what the 20th century saw. It saw the creation of a three-stage life, and actually saw the creation of two new stages of life, teenagers and retirees. People didn't used to retire, but they did. But what we're seeing now is people not being able to afford to retire at 65 if they're living to 85. And I think there's two major challenges people face right now. One is they tend to underestimate their life expectancy. They're often basing it on their grandparents or their parents. But if every generation is living 6 to 9 years longer, that's not a good guess. And then, of course, the other problem we've got right now is such low interest rates, which just add to the problem.
You know, one thing that we've also seen along with the expansion of longevity is the changing workforce. If you take a look at 19th century America, most individuals worked on the farm. You began the early 20th century, individuals worked in the factory. And then you take a look at, you know, from factory jobs, they decreased in this country. You're seeing more professional jobs, office, and the service sector. How much of a role is technology playing in this? Because, I mean, when you were doing manual labor, like working on the farm, doing construction, manual labor, there was a limitation in terms of your body, what you can do. But when you're talking about something like a professional or a skilled job where you're using more of your cognitive abilities than anything else, what role is technology playing here?
Yeah, that's a very good point. And I think there's good and bad pluses here. I mean, the first is you're going to see a lot of technology that aims to augment you. So for instance, I suspect within the next 20, 30 years, we'll see the end of wheelchairs, because if you can have driverless cars, you're going to get robotic legs. So there'll be a whole lot of physical support that will help you age better. But you're right. If it's not physical labor, then your earnings peak goes later. And a really big issue is, you know, how creative, how innovative, and how sharp can people be as they get older? We've traditionally thought that people become, you know, less sharp mentally, less innovative, and less creative. But it is interesting, if we are living for longer and active for longer, whether we can maintain those levels of skills. On the negative side with technology, you talked about how people used to be in the farms and then the factories and now the offices. Of course, over a 60-year career, you're going to see a huge amount of technological change. And I think particularly people in their mid-40s looking over the next 25 years, if you look at the whole big data, artificial intelligence debate, a lot of those office jobs are going to be really threatened by the rise of technology. So one of the things we push people to focus on is not just investing in their finances to look after their pension, but you have to start thinking about your skills and your knowledge and not just rely upon what you learned in your 20s.
You know, one of the chapters in your book, you talk about intangibles and looking at assets in a different perspective. You have three categories. You have one called productive assets, second, vitality assets, and number three, transformational assets. Andrew, spend just a few minutes and explain those terms to our listeners and what they mean.
Sure. Thank you. Our thesis is that we structure life to make it as best as we can. And our current view of life is structured over 70 years, but now we're living for longer, we have to change how we do things. So, you know, the metaphor we use is that I said earlier that every 10 years, life expectancy goes up by 2 or 3. That's a bit like saying the end of every day, here's another 6 or 8 hours. And if you did have another 6 to 8 hours every day, you'd restructure the day. You wouldn't get out of bed the same time. You wouldn't get to sleep the same time. You wouldn't have 3 meals equally spread out. You might have more meals, smaller meals. You might nap at lunchtime. So we need to restructure time. So the question is, how should we restructure over a 100-year life? Because we don't think you can just carry on extending that working phase. Because if you do extend your working phase, you take care of your finances, but not anything else. So we think of how you can support a good life, and clearly financial assets is part of it. But what we call the intangible assets are crucial. So productive assets are what makes me productive at work. It's the skills and knowledge I have. It's my network, my professional networks, and my reputation. And something that people, I think, have to bear in mind if they're not retiring at 60 but mid-70s, how do they maintain their investment in their skills and knowledge? The second really important one we call vitality assets, and there's kind of two types. Part of that is just your mental and physical fitness. And again, you've got to be happy psychologically. You've got to be well physically. And that all involves time and investment on your part. But crucially, it involves family and friendships. And every lifetime study of happiness says that family and friendships is what really matters. So again, if you just carry on working to your mid-70s, you're not investing in those friendships and relationships. But the really important one that we think is going to rise in its priority is what we call transformational assets. This is your ability to deal with change. Traditionally, as people get older, they don't go through change. If I think about my father, he worked for 45 years. When he retired, he'd say, "Dad, what did you do?" And he'd say, "I worked in the newspaper industry." Now, that's a lovely example because I can't imagine my children even know what a newspaper is, let alone what an industry is. And that's how I identify himself. But over a 60-year career with many changes, you've got to be able to adapt and invest in a new way of doing things. So that's about making yourself exposed to new ideas, a broader network, and being happy with change. And change is hard as you get older. But in this longer life, this multi-stage life, we believe you really got to invest in that change.
You know, let's talk about how this might change in this three-stage scenario. So let's take a typical scenario. One-third of a person's life up until their early 20s is spent in education. They have a 30 to 40-year working career and they retire. Let's talk about a stage that comes after retirement. For example, an executive who at age 65 decides to go back to school or pursue a different career in a different education and begin a whole new set that extends that working career. Let's talk about what that scenario might look like.
Absolutely. And, you know, it obviously depends very much on your age, what options you've got. I mean, the way we put it is that when life has gone from 70 years to 100 years, you're running no longer running a 10-mile race, but a 15-mile race. And you have to pace yourself differently. Of course, the younger generation, no doubt at the beginning, but people in their 50s and 60s have been running a 10-mile race and now find out it's a 12-mile race. So how do you keep going? How do you extend? And part of that is answering the question, what job do I do after retirement? And, you know, there's a variety of options there. One thing you can just try and carry on doing what you've always done and just stretch it out. That's delicate because you're probably going to find yourself becoming a little bit irrelevant at work and less productive, and that's going to affect your welfare and your sort of sense of well-being. So then, you know, what other options have you got? One is perhaps in your 50s or 55 to invest in skills relevant to your industry and upgrade your future or shift to a new firm, perhaps a startup. Another one, though, is to just change, as you say, to sort of say, well, I've always fancied doing this. And what we're beginning to see in people in their 60s, and it's actually shared with people in their 20s, is a new type of entrepreneurship. It's kind of people who are following an interest. They're blending work and leisure together. They're earning money, but they're really just earning enough money to sort of cover their expenses because they don't want to touch their pension. But it's a sort of interesting sort of new form of entrepreneurship. I'm not trying to build up a company that I'm going to sell for millions. This is something I'm doing because I enjoy it or because I'm learning about it. And I'm, say, blending work and leisure together in a slightly new way. The pop-up is the most obvious example of this. You know, the whole notion of a pop-up also contains a notion of it popping and disappearing. So it's a sort of fleeting, transient form, but something that gets you interested. So being entrepreneurial is certainly something we're seeing big increases in 60-year-olds and 20-year-olds. The other thing people often try and do is what's called a portfolio model, which is nice if you can pull it off, but somewhat challenging. And that may be, you know, you do one day a week, perhaps helping out a charity one day a week, perhaps working previously in your firm or your sector. But you have a balance of activities that fill your time. It's a little bit like a sort of more sedate and more luxurious gig economy.
So as we look at this, I want to talk about some of the problems that it presents. One is something that I recently had a discussion with Robert Merton at Harvard University, and he talked about money doesn't buy what it used to. You alluded to this earlier. In other words, if I had $1 million, which most people would consider a lot of money, what $1 million produced an income in the year 2000 and what $1 million produces income in the year 2016 are totally different. So when everybody's planning for retirement or thinking of planning for retirement, the numbers don't work in the same way that they used to.
Absolutely. So which is, you know, why you then have bringing that new variable, which is when do I actually stop work? Even if you've retired, then maybe something you want to carry on doing. And I think that has to be, however uncomfortable, is part of the solution. But once you start thinking of your portfolio, not just as investing in financial assets and the income they generate, but with these low interest rates, you may have to work for longer. So how do I invest in my health so I can do that? How do I invest in my skills and networks? I've still got something to do. And it's about a much broader approach to planning for retirement than just investing in your finances. There are all these financial assets available. And so I think, you know, it's a real struggle because I think you've got a bunch of people who may not have saved enough in the past. They're now being surprised by how long they may live for, so they need more money. And that's happening at the same time as rates returns are so weak, which is why, as I say, it just seems inevitable in some form you're going to have to be economically active for longer. The good news is you've got more life and you should be healthier on average, so you can work for longer. But you've got to make some very hard decisions to make sure that work is productive and useful. And then there's one other risk, and it is a risk. We talked earlier about Alzheimer's, but there's something interesting happening. For most of human history, most people sort of died younger than the average. But because of medical progress, we're seeing more and more people living longer than the average. So it's not just that on average people are living for longer, you're also seeing some really long-lived people. So somehow we have to take care of that risk as well. So there's a lot of big financial challenges here. But I think the key issue is they can't all be solved just by saving. There's a whole raft of decisions we have to make to make sure that this longer life is a good life. And it's not just focusing on the finances.
Andrew, I want to talk about some of the challenges this is going to present for society and especially government. We've already seen that transformation take place in the corporate sector. If you went back 30, 40 years ago, most corporations that individuals worked for, whether you were at GM or another corporation, had a defined benefit pension plan where you were assured when you retired after 20, 30 years with the company, you got a nice pension that covered a good majority of your salary. That's pretty much gone away, and the risk is now on the individual with 401k plans. The last remaining sector is government, but if you look at the strains that are being placed on municipal, city budgets, and state budgets with pensions, many of these cities are going bankrupt because of these pensions. So how much longer before government wakes up to the fact that they can't afford these pension plans anymore?
I agree, and I think a lot of people think they've got some pension, and they may not, because there'll be a lot of redefinitions. I think this has become a huge issue politically. I think government's already trying to do it. You've obviously seen in the US measures to try and persuade people to take retirement pay later rather than earlier, and providing quite big incentives. You've seen the retirement age being pushed back. I think one of the challenges is that governments are behind the curve, and too much of this debate quickly comes into a big discussion about pensions and Alzheimer's. It's about this sort of unpleasant end of life stage. So I think we do really need urgently to try and create a more positive environment for this debate, because, you know, this is fundamentally good news. Society is on average living for longer and is healthier for longer. And although there comes a price tag with that, this is something we should be able to make the most of. But if we carry on with our current institutions, both financial and work-based, then this is going to be a real problem. And, you know, you talk about the government, and I think there's also a major inequality issue here, by the way, because, you know, the gap between the rich and the poor in terms of life expectancy is about 20 years. And that's, you know, just going to be adding to that burden. In fact, in some of the lower income groups, you're seeing life expectancy decline rather than increase. So there's a very big gap that's beginning to open up, which needs to be tackled. The other problem, I think, is in the corporate world, where, you know, we're talking here about the need to work for longer, and that could be a positive thing. But so much of corporate practice is tending to go the other way. And above a certain age, you tend to get rid of workers. So there's a really big social change that's underway. And you can see right now, I think a lot of people, whether it be 20 or 70, already beginning to change and adapt and change social norms. The government has made something of a start, but has to do a whole lot more. But corporates aren't even beginning to touch this issue.
You know, this is an issue also I want to bring back in terms of technology. Let's say you are one of those individuals, you're heading closer to retirement, you don't have the assets or the pension plan that you thought you were going to have, but perhaps you cannot remain on your job longer than you had hoped. Let's talk about skill sets that individuals need to develop for this new technologically fast-paced society that we live in. Because one of the problems that you have with student loans today, a lot of students have gone to college, they've amassed debt, but they got an education or a skill set that is no longer needed in society.
I think that's right. I think it's been a really interesting combination, because particularly for the younger generation, I think they kind of need two things. One is they need to have a great deal of specialism so that they can offer something more than a computer. But the trouble is, any specialism will become redundant over time as technology advances. So you also, I think, at a young age, need to learn how to be flexible and critically minded, so you can learn how to learn again later. For an older group, you know, clearly technology has both pros and cons. What is interesting is there's quite a lot of evidence is just as you get older, the way your brain works shifts, and it's less good at working out things from first principles, working things out logically. But it's much better at sort of pattern recognition and systems. I suspect in an older age, we'd have called that wisdom. And if you look at where technology is going, more and more people argue that technology brings us knowledge, but what's going to be important is decision-making and judgment and personal skills. And that is surely something where I think older individuals can have a strength. So I suspect that is the area to move into.
So if somebody is approaching this new transformational age that we've been talking about here, dealing with longevity, technology is certainly changing the workplace makeup. What should an individual do? I mean, one thing I would think would be very important is if you're going to have to work, you're going to have to consider maybe a second career. Where do you go, Andrew, to look at what are the jobs that are going to be out there? Because in certain sectors, whether it's manufacturing and others, the companies are crying out for individuals who have a great skill set.
And I think, you know, one of the challenges here is it depends so much on your age, both because obviously the older you are, you know, the more you follow the path and the less time you've got. But also because longevity has been increasing all the time, the younger you are, not only the more flexibility because you can choose your starting point, you've got a much longer horizon to make things work. So, you know, if you think about someone, the classic baby boomer coming up to retirement, the first thing you'll do is do some really hard thinking about your finances and probably recognize if you haven't saved enough, you may have to work longer. Then the question is, how are you going to do that in a way that's palatable and supportive for your health? And it may well be, you know, a part-time job. It may be something more entrepreneurial. But you've got to take stock of what you can do. The other thing that's really important, keep focusing on saving, but also think about your spending habits. I mean, really getting realistic about spending habits is important. For someone 45, 50, I think this is a real wake-up time for them. They probably have got another 25, 27 years to go in their career. And when you tell people that, it's like a shock to them because they think, wow, can I carry on doing this? Will technology replace me? What skills do I need to do? What are the new industries? How do I become relevant? And I'd say that flexible, creative thinking, judgment and personal skills, I think, are very much the way to go. Then if you're the very young generation, I think what's interesting there is you have to understand that I think the millennials are the first generation really recognizing that the three-stage life and a 70-year life is not going to work for them. So they're doing things at a very, very different pace. And I think what's particularly interesting with them is you're seeing them delaying making commitments. And I think at one level, an older generation would say, well, you're not making commitments. But what they're really doing is keeping their options open. And that makes a lot of sense. You look at financial theory, options are more valuable the longer over the period in which they're held. And as life extends, options become more important. So I think this is that key issue. If you're in your 20s or your mid-40s, you've got to be investing in options because they've become a lot more important. If you're older, you've got fewer options, but you will need to think about how you're going to carry on working into your 70s and therefore what is going to work for you.
Andrew, have you looked at a particular profession or skill set that you see great demand for going forward? So if somebody is in that position, whether they're Gen Xer in their 40s or let's say a baby boomer heading close to retirement that they can look into, is there something that stands out to you?
So if you look at most of the economic analysis on this, I'm thinking of the work done by David Alter at MIT. Basically, what you find is that the thing that just is always increasing in demand are what he calls non-routine cognitive jobs or non-routine cognitive tasks. So cognitive means you're using your brain rather than your physical strength. A non-routine means it's something that's not so easily programmed. You know, it's not just here's the data, you process the data, and there's the answer. So non-routine cognitive tasks. That could be to do with being a therapist and helping someone. It could be to do with being an artist or an entrepreneur. But anything that involves that non-routine cognitive tasks seems to be the thing that is still resistant to artificial intelligence. And where as we get richer, we just have a higher and higher demand for it.
Well, you know, Andrew, this is a very fascinating book because we are seeing traces of everything you talk about in the book, whether it's transformational change brought about by technology. Look what's happened to various businesses. Look what happened to Kodak with digital photography. Look what happened to digital photography with smartphones. And it's something I think we all need to prepare for, not only as an individual, but as a society. Andrew, I want to thank you for joining us on Lifetime Income. Fascinating book. The name of the book is called The 100-Year Life, Living and Working in an Age of Longevity by Linda Grattan and Andrew Scott, who has joined me on the program today. Andrew, thank you so much for giving us your time.
My pleasure, Jim. It's been fascinating. Thank you very much.
Very fascinating book. And I would advise you, if you're thinking about retirement, even if you're a Gen Xer in your 40s, pick up a copy of this because they're talking about trends that we're definitely starting to see. I mean, think about some of the things that we've seen in the corporate sector. Defined benefit pension plans are on the way out. And as I've been warning on this program, defined benefit pension plans by government are going to be on their way out. It's bankrupting a lot of states and municipalities. They're not simply going to be able to afford those kind of programs and look for changes in the coming years. I don't care who's going to occupy the White House. Those changes are coming. And not to mention the fact we live in a world of low interest rates. Money doesn't buy what it used to be. So you might want to think about how you might rework your retirement. Give you a hint, working longer is one possible solution. Well, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. We wanted to use this interview with this book because it played in very well with the subject matter that we covered in Lifetime Income on Monday. Hope you enjoyed the interview and highly recommend getting the book, especially if you're very healthy now, you come from a family with longevity in it, and you consider yourself in good shape and good health, something to think about. In the meantime, until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.